Imam Khomeini guided the Iranian nation to determine their own fate. June 4, 2021. The televised speech delivered on June 4, 2021 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the 32nd demise anniversary of Imam Khomeini. Greetings be upon him. In the Holy Quran and in Islamic narrations, there are many clear points about people's duty towards the fate of their society. All of you have responsibilities towards those under your protection. It means that everyone is responsible towards society. Another narration says, "He who wakes the morning without caring for the affairs of Muslim is not a Muslim." The affairs of Muslims means the affairs of the Islamic community, which includes all affairs. We can also cite the well-known Siffin sermon, where we can find many points about government. The commander of the faithful, greetings be upon him, says something in that sermon which is very important in my opinion. And it is an obligatory right of God over the people that they should advise each other to the best of their ability and cooperate with each other for the establishment of haq among them. Nahjul Balagha, sermon number 216. One of the most important rights of God over His servants is cooperate with each other for the establishment of haq among them. Subhanallah, hamdan lillah, wa la ilaha illallah. Subhanallah, hamdan lillah, wa la ilaha illallah. They should cooperate so as to establish haq in society. This is the people's responsibility, so the people are responsible. They should help establish the government of haq and of God in the country. The duty to counsel to do good is a public responsibility, and one of the most important cases of counsel to do good concerns the establishment of the government of truth and justice. There should exist just government in society. This should be a government of truth, and the people should counsel each other to do good. This shows the people's duty. Another duty is to combat various forms of corruption in society. In another sermon, the commander of the faithful says that one of the reasons why he accepted governance was, "And if there had been no pledge of Allah with the learned to the effect that they should not acquiesce in the gluttony of the oppressor and the hunger of the oppressed, I would have cast the rope of caliphate on its own shoulders." Nahjul Balagha, sermon number 3.
This is IRIB English Radio. website is www.parstoday.com/en. From the very heart of evergreen forests, under the starry sky of the desert, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains, close up, Iran.
Hello, I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. Shopping is one of my favorite things to do. No matter where I go shopping, either in a big modern shopping mall or in an old market, I consider it really enjoyable. Today I'm going to visit a historical market in Tehran, Kuche Marvi. Kuche Marvi, literally Marvi Alley, is a historical alley and one of the oldest shopping centers of Tehran. Kuche Marvi is one of the must-see places in Tehran, which dates back to 200 years ago. In Kuche Marvi, some retail and wholesale products, including cosmetics, clothing, antiques, and food, are sold. Kuche Marvi is located near the Grand Bazaar of Tehran. There are several historical monuments in and around Kuche Marvi. Among them, mention can be made of Shamsul Emare Edifice, Saray Roshan Building, Marvi High School, Marvi Mosque, Saray Muzaffarian, Marvi Old Bazaar, and Agha Mahmud Mosque. In the past, Arab migrants and Iranians who used to reside in Iraq did business in this bazaar. Therefore, elements of Arabic culture is visible in this alley. I am now at the beginning of Kuche Marvi. Here, there is a square with a beautiful statue at its core. This is the statue of a man pulling a cart with his kid. It's fantastic. I'd like to take a photo from it. At the beginning of Kuche Marvi, there is one of the oldest restaurants of Tehran which sells falafel. Falafel is a type of food which is popular in southern Iran, though its original form is Arabic. Oh, what an appetizing smell! First, I will eat a sandwich of falafel and then I continue my market walking tour. Thank you. Kuche Marvi, it's like hitting two birds with one stone. You know why? You can both shop and at the same time enjoy seeing the historical monuments. All the stores have really beautiful and magnificent walls. Oh my God! There are everything in these stores. Everything that you could imagine. Haberdashery shops next to cosmetic shops. Oh, food product shops. Different types of tea, coffee, chocolate. I will buy some Arabic coffee for my grandma at the end of my tour. Oh, look! An old tree. It is standing tall even after reconstruction of the alley. No damage to the tree. Great! It has been passed through the vaults. And I am now standing beside Aga Mahmud Mosque. This mosque belongs to Safavid era. Walking in this historical alley gives me a really good feeling. It's as if time has gone backwards, and I am walking in old Tehran. Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashmi. Thanks so much for being with us. The Saudi regime-led coalition started its war on the enemy people, in 2014 with the hope of their bombing campaign and onslaught not taking more than a month or two to defeat them. Now, 7 years later, it is the Yemeni forces which have turned the tables and are now retaliating with its latest offensive on Ma'arib. Shocking the Saudi regime. Stay with us as we take a look at what it all means on this spotlight. I'd like to start this off with our correspondent in Sanaa, Abdellatif Al-Washali. Abdellatif, fill us in on the latest situation of what is taking place.
Yes, thank you so much. The Yemeni army has successfully accomplished the second phase of Al-Nasr al-Mubin operation. Nata and Nu'man regions were fully liberated from the Saudi-backed terrorist groups in this operation. Almost 390 squared kilometers were liberated. The Yemeni army launched this operation and the first stage of this operation almost 2 weeks ago. The Yemeni army confiscated a huge number of weapons. They are U.S. made, according to military experts, and this is yet another proof of the U.S. military support for the terrorist groups in Yemen, especially in Al Bayda, which is a new front to pressure the Yemeni army to limit its advances toward Marib city. The Minister of Defense today vowed the Saudi-led coalition and vowed all the other forces that they still have many surprises in case the war and the siege are still ongoing against the Yemeni people.
All right, thank you so much, Abdul Latif, for that update. And I'd like to welcome my guest to the program, Brett Yonkers, historian and journalist out of Hausa, and Hossein Al-Bahati, journalist and political commentator out of Sana'a. I'd like to start it off with Brett, your perspective. What has happened that from the beginning of this war, the Saudis were basically expecting to breeze through it, and now they're on the edge of defeat?
I think this is a pretty typical case of imperial arrogance and imperial overstretch, as it is called, in which a nation that is used to being praised as a modern country, as a powerful power, as a power broker in the region, as one of the most, one of the absolute richest countries in the area, in the Arab world, and in fact one of the richest countries in the world, of course, and of course one with a state-of-the-art modern military, has to, whenever a country like that goes to war, of course they have in their mind the idea that this will be fast, this will be easy, this should be no real issue, really. I often compare it a little to what happened in Vietnam in the 1960s and 1970s, when, of course, the most powerful military in the world, the United States of America, went to war against what they saw as a backward Southeast Asian nation and got defeated, terribly defeated, in fact, by the Vietnamese resistance. And this is something that we have seen now. Of course, this war is still dragging on, and there is still a lot of room for changes in the future. Nobody really knows what the future will hold, of course. But the fact that we are now almost 7 years later and Yemen is still standing strong is by itself already a victory, because, as you mentioned, indeed, the Saudis and the Emiratis and their allies, they went to war in 2015 with the idea of being in Sana'a in a matter of weeks, in fact. And they have not done this. In fact, they have lost almost all control over the actual battlefield. They are sending Sudanese mercenaries. Now, recently, they are sending mercenaries from other East African countries. Mm-hmm. They are sending child soldiers to do the dirty fighting for them. But they are completely incapable of holding on to any real power on the ground. They are incapable of holding on to the central of Yemen, and even nowadays to the south. Even in Aden and Hadramaut, deep in the south of Yemen, which has been occupied for 6 years, they are losing control. And now, of course, when you see that Marib is at the verge of being liberated by the Yemeni forces of the National Salvation Government in Sana'a, and when you see the operation al-Nasr al-Mubin now happening in the province of Bayda, this is all a massive propaganda failure, of course, for the Saudis. They are being defeated over and over and over again by people who have nothing except for their tenacity and except for their dedication to their independence,
okay,
and their sovereignty.
All right, well, let me get Hossein in on this conversation. How have Ansarullah and Yemeni forces been able to be successful when there is a land, sea, and air siege on the country that's been implemented by the Saudis and allowed by their Western partners, such as the United States?
First of all, the Saudi blockade and total attacks and strikes have killed maybe 20,000 Yemeni civilians, including many children, and the blockade has killed more than 300,000 Yemenis, most of them children from severe malnutrition and from other diseases. This actually exposed the Saudi coalition backed by the United States that they actually don't want any peace for Yemen. They do want Yemen to be free, and as well what they have done in the south. Saudi coalition claimed that the war against Ansarullah the Houthi is, as they say, to tackle down that coup and to bring Hadi legitimacy into Sana'a. But still, we've seen in the south that United Arab Emirates, they have created the so-called Southern Transition Council, which actually does not recognize Hadi government. They see the security situation in the south, how Al-Qaeda is running freely there, how Al-Qaeda is working side by side with Saudi and as well with the United Arab Emirates to fight the Houthi, and as well there are shortages of fuel, no security. I mean, everything there is upside down. That's why Yemenis actually have realized that this war actually is not about legitimacy, is about to bring Hadi to Yemen. Hadi, who is actually a puppet or a tool in the hand of Saudi and United States. And on the other hand, we see in areas under the control of Sana'a forces, there is well-tight security. Al-Qaeda has been eliminated from areas under the control of Sana'a. The only thing that Sana'a and areas under control of Sana'a government is the fuel shortages, food shortages, and this actually is because of the direct blockade. I just want to add that in the last 3 months since Biden has actually sworn as United States President, we have seen actually one of the largest fuel shortages in Yemen history, not only in during the 7 years of Saudi war. And this actually exposed that the United States, especially Biden, they want to use the weapon of blockade more against Yemenis. And one final thing, why Yemenis actually are successful, because Yemeni have actually relied on military equipment that they have. They actually upgraded their military equipment, and they stay resistant to fight Saudi, and they don't want to surrender or to give up towards Saudi coalition.
Well, Brett, I mean, we've heard from various UN agencies about the humanitarian suffering and disaster which is taking place in Yemen due to the siege and bombings, but we haven't seen much action. We've heard a lot of talk. Why is that the case?
Because this war is an extremely profitable business venture for a lot of Western nations, and especially, of course, their arms corporations. The Saudi war machine is oiled and supplied almost completely, of course, by the United States and by the United Kingdom and by France. These are, and in certain ways also by the Zionist entity of Israel, these are billions and billions of dollars that are spent by the Saudi regime every single year since 2015 in trying to keep up the war machine that they have built up. Like I said, it's a state-of-the-art war machine, but the problem is that the Saudis have shown themselves time and time again completely incapable of using this high-tech weaponry. So basically what they're doing is they're sending the best they have in terms of equipment into the battlefield in Yemen, where they lose it almost immediately, to sometimes makeshift weaponry, improvised explosives, or sometimes even due to the fact that the Yemeni forces, they chase away the drivers of the vehicles and then burn them by just using matches and petroleum. So every time this happens, of course, the Saudis are in need of further military purchases. And aside from the obvious economic advantages this brings to these arms corporations in the West, there is the fact that this is it's a sort of propaganda war as well. Saudi Arabia has window dressed this entire conflict as a battle against what they call Iranian proxies, which is objectively untrue, because there is no Iranian influence, nor any Iranian troops have there ever been in Yemen. But this window dressing has been accepted as fact by the Western mainstream media. So if now they were to accept the fact that Saudi Arabia were to retreat or were to lose too easily, this can be constructed, can be perceived as a victory for Iran, which is, of course, a very easy victory for Iran, considering that Iran didn't actually have to do anything in order to win this propaganda victory, because they're not technically involved. But this is another reason, I think, why, from an ideological viewpoint for the West, this is very important to keep this war going and to try to get as much as they can out of this conflict. Mm. The Saudis themselves, of course, have always have had a very strategic objective and very strategic interest in this region. We're talking, of course, Yemen, which borders the Bab al-Mandab Strait, which borders the Red Sea connection that goes eventually to the Suez Canal and that way to the Mediterranean. And, of course, the Arab Sea, which is the gateway into the Indian Ocean, the Indian subcontinent, and further into Asia. We already have seen that in several southern and eastern Yemeni provinces, the ones that have been occupied by Saudi Arabia for going on 7 years now, there are massive oil pipelines that have been constructed already that will lead to port cities in Yemen that are occupied by Saudi Arabia and the UAE. The goal of this is to make sure that Saudi Arabia can export oil, can pump oil from their own deserts and partially also from Yemen, straight onto the Yemeni coast, straight onto the Arabian Sea, and this way they can completely circumvent things like the Red Sea or the Persian Gulf, which of course for Saudi Arabia, it saves money, it saves time, and it would be an incredibly profitable, again, business venture that they are going for.
All right.
So for the entire thing, basically, the point is that for the West, it's all about money and about power in the end. They don't care about the humanitarian cost that this actually brings in the to the field in Yemen itself.
Okay. Well, Hussein, the latest offensive by the Yemeni forces is taking place in Ma'arib. And tell us about Ma'arib and why this particular offensive is so significant.
The latest offensive, as example, that took place in Al-Baida province, central Yemen. Yemeni army has controlled about 400 square kilometers, and those area were under a total control of Al-Qaeda, and it's known that those one of the strongest or safe haven for Al-Qaeda. And when actually who opened that front is the Saudi-backed the Saudi coalition side by side with Al-Qaeda and ISIS, because they want to reduce the pressure on Ma'arib. They thought that Sana'a forces cannot fight in many front at one time, and what actually Yemeni army have shown here in Sana'a, that they are well equipped to attack anywhere, and they are well equipped as well to continue their attack to liberate Ma'arib. And I just want to see, we have seen the amount of outcry from the United States, United Nations, UK, and other countries who support this war against Yemen. They are crying out loud about the liberation of Ma'arib, and as well what happened in Al-Baida. We haven't, because they said of the civilians in Ma'arib, but they totally ignore when Saudi coalition were like maybe 20 kilometers east of Sana'a in Nahum. Nobody has said don't enter Sana'a, which have about 500 million Yemeni civilians. The attack against Hudaydah, we didn't see any condemnation from the United Nations or UN or any other organization. This is actually because the United States want Yemen to stay a hub for Al-Qaeda. They have moved Al-Qaeda from Afghanistan to Iraq, to Syria, to Libya, and now they want to have a safe haven in this area because they have almost lost the war against Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan, and because Iraqi and Syrians have actually defeated Al-Qaeda, they want to have this hub, which Ma'arib actually now is have many hundreds of fighters from Al-Qaeda and ISIS who are fighting side by side. As well, there are four officials who work with Hadi government who are actually in the so-called treasury list of the United States for supporting Al-Qaeda. One of them is Al-Jouf governor, who have actually fled Al-Jouf when Sana'a Force has liberated. And as well, the brother of the governor of Ma'arib, he is as well in that terrorist list. Hadi so-called advisor, Al-Humaykani, he's from Al-Baida. He's going in and out from Riyadh. He's on that list. And to show you exactly, United States is only using Al-Qaeda to fight and to create fight against Yemeni civilians like they did before.
Okay.
And they're using this crying out loud because they don't want Ma'arib to be liberated. And as well, Ma'arib have the oil field and gas field in the only place in Yemen. And Saudi actually is exporting millions of barrels since this war began against Yemen, because they want to support the war from revenue that comes from Yemeni oil.
Okay.
Because the economy has become really weak since the war started.
What about that, Brett? I mean, we have seen more of an outcry from various Western entities and television stations or networks in dealing with the situation of Ma'arib, as Hussein said, condemning it and talking about the humanitarian disaster that could take place. I mean, it just seems that more and more they're exposing their hypocrisy. Your assessment of it?
Well, of course, every time when you see Western pundits and Western news outlets report on situations like this, especially, of course, every time they talk about when the quote-unquote Houthis, so the forces of the National Salvation Government in Sana'a, are making progress, then suddenly, of course, the alarm bells are going off all across Europe and the West in general. And in many ways, this is similar to back in the day when the war was going on in Syria around Aleppo, when now as well still nowadays in the region of Idlib. Every time the Syrian Arab army says, finally, this is now enough is enough, all peace talks have failed, the rebels, the terrorist forces are still there on Syrian soil, and we want to do something about it. Every time the Syrian army finally moves forward, even after all these years of waiting and negotiating, then suddenly, of course, the alarm bells are going off, and there are talks about how terrible the situation is and how horrible the Syrian Arab army is mistreating its own civilians. In some ways, this is similar in Yemen. Of course, it is different because the Yemeni National Salvation Government is not portrayed as a regime in the West, but they are portrayed as being the rebels, which by itself is ridiculous because they rule over the absolute majority of the Yemeni population and are the only of two governments that have any form of popular legitimacy in the eyes of the people themselves. But that's a different discussion, of course. But aside from that, the reporting is similar. Whenever the National Salvation Government advances, like, for example, on Marib, they're saying there are reports in the West coming out and saying, oh, there's famine in Marib, there's problem in Marib, people are dying because of the shelling and because of the bombardments. And unfortunately, obviously, that is true. But what they failed to mention is that people have been starving in Yemen every single day for the past 6 to 7 years because of the Saudi blockade. They are trying, of course, in the West to pin it on different sort of things. They're pinning it on, they're making this all both sides are bad story, or they're saying, you know, the Houthis are hogging all the humanitarian aid, the Houthis are destroying the food. They even tried to blame it on the cut, which is that herb that in Yemen that is a popular by hunger suppressant, in fact, that people chew. In the West, they claim, like, because they are growing this crop, they are failing to grow enough food for themselves, etc., etc. So the extent to which this yellow page journalism, this propagandic journalism, will go is absolutely unbelievable when you look at it from an objective viewpoint. But unfortunately, that is, of course, the situation we are in right now. And the reason why they're doing this, of course, is they're trying to play the humanitarian angle in order to justify the maintenance of the status quo. They've always been doing this. Every time a rebel or a revolutionary group pops up that fights against imperialism, that fights against tyranny, that fights against terrorism, these revolutionaries will be portrayed as the new terrorists. They will be portrayed as the ones who disturb the peace. Mm-hmm. There is no talk about the fact that Saudi Arabia is starving the country. No, they talk about the fact that the Houthis fail to surrender, that they refuse to give up. This is lies, basically, that are being spread over and over again. They have done it about Iraq, they have done it about Syria, they have done it about Iran, and now they're doing it about Yemen.
Okay.
And unfortunately, even when they talk about, you know, we should do something about the humanitarian situation, and when they do admit that Saudi Arabia is at fault, they immediately spin it into a both sides are bad story, and their solution will always be, oh, maybe we should negotiate some more, let's host another conference in Geneva or wherever, in order to talk this out, without, of course, addressing the root
problem. All right, stay with me, Brett.
Which is the invasion.
Stay with me, please. Just a few minutes left. I got to get Hossein back in this. Hossein, how likely is it that the Yemeni forces will get total control of Marib? And what would that mean? Would we be seeing the beginning of the end of this terrible war, or your assessment?
I think if Sana'a forces liberated Marib, I think that Saudi will not actually stop its war, and I believe that the United States after that will actually be directly involved in the war of Yemen. I expected they could send hundreds of troops to areas that's under the Saudi-led coalition control, because they know Marib, and the control of Marib means that Sana'a forces are well equipped to actually to liberate all Yemen, and the United States and Saudi doesn't want that. That's why I believe that if Yemeni forces will continue their attack, they shouldn't stop, and as well they should actually keep targeting Saudi Arabia, because in the last few months there were less attack against Saudi Arabia, and now given the Saudi and United States time, they could use they could enforce more blockade against Yemen. They have actually printed Yemeni riyals in the last 7 years, more than what has been printed in the last 25 years. They show you that they want to now to target Yemen by their economy. The exchange rate for dollar here in Sana'a is half now what is actually in Aden, and they show you that here actually they are well equipped to fight the war, either economy by the economy or to fight politically, and as well the main attack against Saudi Arabia, I think it will stop this war. But if we continue just to liberate areas in Yemen without targeting Saudi Arabia, targeting their economy, this means that we're giving Saudi time to enforce more types of blockade against Yemen.
All right, Hossein. Well, Brett, 1 minute. You think the retaliation must continue? And as Hossein, though, he talked about not only retaliation and defending inside of Yemen, but also offensive inside of Saudi Arabia. Your take, 1 minute.
Yeah, and if I indeed to say it in a short way, I think the Yemenis are definitely within the right to keep attacking, to keep counterattacking, and take back the rest of their country. And in fact, I believe Saudi Arabia should be very, very grateful if they can get out of this war by only having to pull back out of all of the Republic of Yemen. They should be very grateful if they can get to keep Jaizan, Najran, and Asir, because these are regions of Greater Yemen that were stolen by the Saudis in 1934. But if they can to keep this, and if they, if the Yemenis allow them, allow the Saudis to keep this part of Saudi Arabia and do not reclaim it back for Yemen, the Saudis should be very, very fortunate, because that's the best possible outcome for them that they can still have in this war.
And on that note, I'd like to thank both of you for being with us here on the Spotlight. Brett Yonkers, historian and journalist out of House of Saud, and Hossein al-Bahati, journalist and political commentator out of Sana'a. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi, signing off for myself and all the crew right here in Tehran. Thanks so much, and goodbye.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 15:20 to 16:20 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 19:20 to 20:20 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat, or BAT 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/EN. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
limelight.
COVID has claimed more than 600,000 lives in the U.S., and researchers calculated that for every 13 deaths caused by the virus, one child under 18 has lost a parent. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Jonelle Alicia Ryder. This article is published under the heading, More Than 46,000 U.S. Children Have Lost At Least One Parent to COVID. Stay tuned for more. Five months after her husband died of COVID, Valerie Villegas can see how grief has wounded her children. Nicholas, the baby who was one and almost weaned when his father died, now wants to nurse at all hours. Robert III regularly collapses into furious tantrums, stopped using the big boy potty, and frets about sick people giving him germs. Aiden, 5, recently announced it's his job to be strong and protect his mom and brothers. Her older kids, Kay Flora, 13, Andrew Vase, 16, and Alexis Vase, 18, are often quiet and sad or angry, depending on the day. The two oldest, gripped by anxiety that makes it difficult to concentrate or sleep, were prescribed antidepressants soon after losing their stepfather. But in a nation where researchers calculate that more than 46,000 children have lost one or both parents to COVID since February 2020. Villegas and other survivors say finding basic services for their bereaved kids, counseling, peer support groups, financial assistance has been difficult, if not impossible. Interviews with nearly 24 researchers, therapists, and other experts on loss and grief, as well as families whose loved ones died of COVID, reveal the extent to which access to grief groups and therapists grew scarce during the pandemic. Providers scrambled to switch from in-person to virtual visits, and waiting lists swelled, often leaving bereft children and their surviving parents to cope on their own. Losing a parent is devastating to a child, said Alisa Label, a San Diego therapist and program manager with Smart Care Behavioral Health Consultation Services. Losing a parent during a pandemic is a special form of torture. Children can receive survivor benefits when a parent dies if that parent worked long enough in a job that required payment of Social Security taxes. During the pandemic, the number of minor children of deceased workers who receive new benefits has surged, reaching nearly 200,000 in 2020, up from an average of 180,000 in the previous 3 years. Social Security Administration officials don't track cause of death, but the latest figures mark the most award granted since 1994. COVID death undoubtedly fueled that spike, according to SSA's Office of Chief Accuracy. And the number of children eligible for those benefits is surely higher. Only about half of the 2 million children in the U.S. who have lost a parent as of 2014 received the Social Security benefits to which they were entitled, according to a 2019 analysis by David Weaver of the Congressional Budget Office. Counselors said they find many families, and they have no idea that children qualify for benefits when a working parent dies or don't know how to sign up. COVID COVID has claimed more than 600,000 lives in the U.S., and researchers writing in the journal JAMA Pediatrics calculated that for every 13 deaths caused by the virus, one child under 18 has lost a parent. As of June 15th, that would translate into more than 46,000 kids, researchers estimated. Three-quarters of the children are adolescents. The others are under age 10. About 20% of the children who have lost parents are black, though they make up 14% of the population. There is this shadow pandemic, said Rachel Kidman, an associate professor at Stony Brook University in New York, who was part of the team that found a way to calculate the impact of COVID deaths. There is a huge amount of children who have been bereaved. The Biden administration, which launched a program to help pay funeral costs for COVID victims, did not respond to questions about offering targeted services for families and children. Failing to address the growing cohort of bereaved children, whether in a single family or in the U.S. at large, could have long-lasting effects, researchers said. The loss of a parent in childhood has been linked to a higher risk of substance use, mental health problems, poor performance in school, lower college attendance, lower employment, and early death. Bereavement is the most common stress and the most stressful thing people go through in their lives, said clinical psychologist Christopher Lane of UCLA, Duke University National Center for Child Traumatic Stress. It merits the care and concern. Perhaps 10% to 15% of children and others bereaved by COVID might meet the criteria of a new diagnosis, prolonged grief disorder, which can occur when people have a specific long-lasting responses to the death of a loved one. That could mean thousands of children with symptoms that warrant clinical care. This is literally a national, very public health emergency, Lane said. Still, Villegas and others say they have been left largely on their own to navigate a confusing patchwork of community services for their children, even as they struggle with their own grief. I called the counselor at school. She gave me a few little resources on boys and staff, Villegas said. I called some crisis hotline. I called counseling places, but they couldn't help because they had waiting lists and needed insurance. My kids lost their insurance when their dad died, she added. The social disruption and isolation caused by the pandemic overwhelmed grief care providers too. Across the U.S., nonprofit agencies that specialize in childhood grief said they have scrambled to meet the need and to switch from in-person to virtual engagement. It was a huge challenge. It was very far into the way we work, said Vicky Jay, CEO of the National Alliance for Grieving Children. Grief work is based on relationships, and it's very hard to get a relationship with a piece of machinery. At Experience Camps, which each year offers free week-long camps to about 1,000 bereaved kids across the country, the waiting list has grown more than 100% since 2020, said Tyler Bosch, an Experience Camps associate. It is something that we are concerned about. A lot of kids are not getting the support they need, she said. Private counselors, too, have been swamped. Jill Johnson Young, co-owner of Central Counseling Services in Riverside, California, said her nearly 3 dozen Trappists have been booked solid for months. I don't know a Trappist in the area who isn't full right now, she said. Dr. Sandra McGowan-Watts, 47, a family practice doctor in Chicago, lost her husband, Stephen, to COVID in May 2020. She feels fortunate to have found an online therapist for her daughter, Justice, who helped explain why the 12-year-old was suddenly so sad in the mornings. My husband was the one who woke up her for school. He helped her get ready for school. Justice was also able to get a spot at an experienced camp session this summer. I'm nervous about going to camp, but I'm excited about meeting new kids who have also lost someone close in their life, she said. Jamie Stacy, 42, of San Jose, California, was connected with an online counselor for her daughter, but she said it was not enough.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.